This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We're here and we're back. We're ready to talk about what has happened over the last few weeks. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
And we also have a man here in the flesh who is usually on the other side of the world, Brent Noctegal.
Good to be here in person.
And via Skype from Canada. Where are you, Richard, in Canada?
Calgary, Alberta.
Okay, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
It's been 2 weeks since we've, it's been 3 weeks. We were off for 2 weeks. Quite a lot has happened over these past few weeks. As Stephen Flory brought out in the Trumpet Daily this morning, in America you wouldn't really know it because of the wall-to-wall election coverage, but there's actually a lot happening in this world. I got an email this week from someone upset that we're not spending more time on election coverage at the Trumpet. Well, I have good news for this individual. We do have an American political story later on in the program today, but we're going to start with something of greater immediate geopolitical significance than people that Donald Trump may have insulted. The cover story of this week's Trumpet Weekly: Houthi rebels challenge U.S. Navy in Gulf of Aden. We're actually playing a bit of catch-up here. This happened a few weeks ago. Brent Noctegal spoke about this during a Trumpet Daily program a couple of weeks ago and also yesterday. Many of our listeners may not have heard that. So we're going to start by going straight to Brent.
Yeah, it's important that we cover this because it's something we have been watching for specifically for the past 5 years, for Iran's influence to be extended all the way around from the Persian Gulf through the Indian Ocean there below Oman and Yemen, and specifically up through the Red Sea Passage, and them trying to control that territory. And what we've seen over the past month is them actually mobilizing one of their proxies, the Houthi rebels that took over the capital of Yemen back in early 2015. And at that time, as we said, that this is going to portend dangerous things and changes in the world scene, specifically through these sea passageways that Yemen controls. Yemen, of course, is right on the eastern side of the Red Sea Passage, and specifically there's a strait, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, 18 miles across, through which all traffic that needs to get to Europe from Asia or from the Middle East, all the oil getting up to Europe into the Mediterranean has to travel through there. So it's critical that that is controlled by a power that is friendly to world shipping, that wants to ensure that it stays open. Well, that has been threatened over the past month, just as we said it was going to be. And it's been threatened by these Iranian-backed Houthi rebels that fired at least three separate missile attacks against the United States Navy, pretty brazen attacks. Each one of these missiles cost $500,000 for them to fire. So this isn't just a ragtag bunch of AK-47-wielding terrorists. This is a seriously funded terrorist group, and they fired at the USS Mason three times in October. The first time didn't hit the Mason. The Mason had some countermeasures to stop that. Those countermeasures cost $8 million to ensure that they were not hit. So they would have been close. These were radar-guided anti-ship missiles fired by the Houthis. After the second attack in halfway through October, the United States decided to respond. They took out three radar stations controlled by the Houthis that were directing these missiles towards the U.S. ships. Everyone rejoiced how awesome that is. The United States finally responded. A week later, the Houthis did the same thing again. They were undeterred by the United States' response. Then even in the past 3 days, we've had the Houthis fire upon commercial vessels that are sailing through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait as well. Now, as even Abraham Blondeau brings out in his article that is featured as a cover story of today's Trumpet Weekly, the Houthis are much smaller or much less effective, I guess, than the United States military. If they were going head-to-head, the U.S. Navy would obviously wipe out the Houthis, could wipe them out in an instant. But what we're seeing is the Houthis doing enough to make the United States question whether it's important for them to be there to maintain traffic through that strait.
Mm-hmm. Can you just shore up the evidence that it is Iran that is really of concern here, that it's this is an Iranian move, it's not just these Houthis that are making these provocations?
There are a number of proofs that the Iranians are backing the Houthis, dating back a few years, just supporting them just because of how excited Iran was, specifically when the Houthis took over the capital of Sana'a. They claimed that, the Iranians claimed that we now control four capitals in the Middle East, Lebanon, Damascus, of course, their own capital, and now they control Sana'a because the Houthis took it over. So the Iranians believe that they are in charge of the Houthis. But then if you actually look at the weaponry that was fired, the C-802 anti-ship missile is exactly the same missile that was fired against an Israeli corvette back in the late 2000s off the coast of Lebanon by Hezbollah. Who funds Hezbollah? Obviously, Iran does that. There's no disputing that, and they're using the same weaponry. There is also another piece in the Trumpet Weekly here that talks about how there were, and the United States has tracked shipments from Iran of arms across Oman. Oman, again, is on the other side of the Strait of Hormuz, on the other side where the Persian Gulf is. And Iran is on the northern side of the Strait of Hormuz, and just 22 miles across the other side, you have Oman. And they've tracked shipments of this type of missile crossing the land into Yemen via Oman as well. So I think there is enough proof that Iran is behind this.
You mentioned this is these attacks are causing America to wonder, do we really want to be in this area? This is obviously a story. I mean, it really ties in with what we were talking about before, just how distracted Americans are by political coverage, but there really seems to be very little will for Americans to put our soldiers at risk, even though there is quite a lot at stake in this area. Maybe you could just talk more about the stakes, what this is, what it means for America to be so
right. War-weary. Well, for about 50 years or 60 years, the United States has maintained the safety over this region, ensured that sea traffic could travel through. It's an important gateway, especially for oil. I think it's about 20% of seaborne oil travels through the Suez Canal, which means it travels right past Yemen. And if that's threatened, you could see oil prices going through the roof, which some Americans might be happy with in the short term because they'd get more money for their own oil. But it does threaten the stability and peace of other parts of the world that are allies with the United States as well. And really, I mean, you just have to ask the question, if it starts in Yemen, off the coast of Yemen, the United States withdrawing its navy from no longer protecting international cargo vessels, international oil tankers traveling through here, then where would it end? Who else would you like to maintain control of the world's sea gates? Who else is going to be as friendly for even American trade traveling through these sea gates? So this would come around to affect America pretty quick.
It seems that this really could increase the provocation that Iran is making against Europe, that we're talking about, just looking at from a prophetic standpoint, Iran's actions really are affecting Europe about as much as anyone, and it's Europe who's ultimately going to have to respond to this.
Right. Europe has the most immediate needs to ensure that this passageway stays open, that Iran doesn't control it, because they benefit the most through exports or imports through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait and the Suez Canal. And that's probably why they are the ones that are going to counter Iran's eventual blockade of this area. That's what we expect. We expect Iran not to go away. We don't expect the U.S. Navy to ensure freedom of navigation through here. We expect Iran to get to the point that people make the calculus, or even commercial people, it might be cheaper for us to travel back around the Cape of Good Hope, even though it extends our journey by a month or so. Because of the threat of our cargo being attacked. And Europe, even as Bible prophecy says, is going to respond to this provocation.
Well, thanks for that, Brent. Another very important story is what is happening in Russia these days. This morning, Stephen Fleury talked about Moscow unveiling its Satan II missile, which is powerful enough to destroy a country. I would really encourage our listeners to take in that program. But here we're going to talk about another alarming story out of Russia. And for this, we will go to Jeremiah.
Yeah, a group of hackers, apparently based in Ukraine, obtained a whole trove of emails from a man named Vladislav Surkov. Mr. Surkov has been one of Russian President Vladimir Putin's chief political allies since the very beginning of his presidency back in 1999. And the hackers have leaked a lot of Mr. Surkov's emails, and they not only prove what basically everybody has always known about Russia being the main force behind all the unrest and destabilization there in eastern Ukraine for the last couple of years, but the emails also say that Russia is now plotting a new phase of this destabilization in the months ahead, to further undermine the government there in Kiev. The most significant part of the email leak was a 22-page document in which Surkov outlines a plot apparently to be implemented later this year and at the beginning of next year for Russia to boost its support of nationalist and separatist politicians in order to basically encourage early parliamentary elections there in Ukraine. And of course, it's all with the aim of stacking parliament with Russia-friendly politicians in order to undermine the sort of the anti-Russian crowd in Kiev. One excerpt from Surkov's leaked email says, "It is necessary to create favorable conditions for controllable political forces to enter the new parliament. Furthermore, as a result of fundamental changes in the Ukrainian political situation, it is now possible to achieve the return of the Donbass to Ukraine on Russia's terms." And it's interesting to me that the Russians are apparently considering returning the eastern Ukrainian region of Donbass to the Ukrainians after they've been essentially occupying it partly vicariously, partly directly for these last few years. But it looks like the overall strategy is to just scale back on the military efforts in Ukraine and to instead focus on political influence there by stacking the deck there in parliament with those Russia-friendly politicians. And this man whose emails were hacked, Vladislav Surkov, he's a guy who criminologists have long viewed as a very influential and interesting figure. He's nicknamed the Gray Cardinal, and he was one of the key players behind Russia's shift away from the Pravda-style propaganda, which basically said the truth is whatever Moscow says it is, and toward RT-style propaganda, which is more like, who can say what the truth really is? Perhaps it's even something quite unexpected, like what's in this article here. So it's a pretty major development in the Kremlin's propaganda war that he was the architect of. And he's also served as the first deputy chief to Putin and then as deputy prime minister. Most recently, he worked as Putin's advisor for the breakaway provinces in Georgia. And he was the chief architect, apparently, of the Crimean annexation. So he's a major player in Russia's foreign affairs and especially its expansionistic policies. And Russia, of course, as you would expect, they deny that these leaked emails are legitimate. They say that these hackers essentially fabricated them. And that is a possibility. But if a plan were in the works for Russia to make a new push against eastern Ukraine and to shift to more of a political focus there, then Surkov would surely be involved at the very highest levels of it.
It's so much focus right now on supposed Russian hacks on American politicians. Seems like they're getting a little bit of their own medicine here. What is there any fallout of this having been exposed, or is Russia's denials, is that sufficient to kind of put a lid on it?
Well, so far, it's only the denials. The fact that they were Ukrainian hackers does, I think, call it into question a little bit. It becomes very much a he said versus he said type situation. A lot of Russian government officials have been instructed to switch back to typewriters
right.
instead of computers to avoid this very type of thing from happening. But apparently Surkov didn't yet do that. And if it is a legitimate hack, then they're now paying the price for it.
Very interesting. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Our next story gives quite a remarkable picture of the state of the European Union today. This political experiment in unification in Europe has been plagued by a number of problems and setbacks, obstacles that biblical prophecy tells us will be forcibly resolved. But for an idea of just how much that robust solution is required if the European project is to be viable politically and economically, we're going to go back to our man in Britain who is in Canada, Richard.
That's right. Seeing as I'm over here in Canada, I thought we'd start with a Canadian story. So the EU has spent the last 7 or 8 years trying to do a trade deal with Canada. And it is quite a big deal. It's quite a deep trade deal. It would cover cover hundreds of millions of dollars each year. But beyond that, this is seen as much more than a deal with Canada. It's seen as a template that the EU can roll out now as they try to form trade deals with other major nations. And so, if they looked at doing a trade deal with China or with the UK after Brexit, it was the Canada model that they were planning on working from. And so, getting to this point has been pretty tricky. There have been a lot of hang-ups. As I said, it's been going on for 7 or 8 years. And throughout all of these negotiations, people have been looking at this. Other nations have been looking at this and saying, wow, if it's this hard for the EU to do a trade deal with Canada, who can they do a trade deal with? And so the whole process, even before the latest news, has been a bit of a farce and has been really inefficient with lots of hang-ups. But it looked like they were finally all done. They were kind of getting ready for the big signing ceremonies. And Justin Trudeau, the Canadian premier, was going to be going over to Europe, etc. And then it was stopped in its tracks, not by a group of EU nations, not even by one EU nation, but one out of three regions in Belgium, Wallonia. So one region of one EU nation completely derailed the deal. It's almost as if Logan County, Oklahoma, could veto what the US government is doing in foreign policy.
Yeah. So, and Belgium isn't exactly a EU powerhouse nation either.
No, exactly. It's got a lot of people now asking questions. It's the kind of incident I think that you could imagine reading about in a history book years later as just epitomizing all of the problems that the EU faced at this time period, and also being something that really was a wake-up call for Europe and getting this problem, making this problem very visible to a lot of people, because Wallonia has been all over the headlines, at least in the European and British newspapers. It's not a region that normally makes the headlines. Now, I will say this deal is kind of back on track now. After all of the signing ceremonies and visits had been cancelled, Wallonia did get a bunch of concessions. Belgium announced yesterday that the deal, that block is removed. So it looks like things will go ahead now. But nevertheless, it still made this mess, very obvious to a lot of people. And the fact still stands that one region of one tiny nation was able to hold the whole of the EU to ransom.
And our Trumpet Weekly report on this story, there's a quote from the EU Observer that says, if the EU is like a fleet of ships, then it can only travel as fast as its slowest ship. And at the moment, great cruise liners are seeing themselves being held back by a rowing boat. How long before they decide to cut the rowing boat loose and dash for the horizon? Maybe you can just tell us about how this really does kind of portend the robust solution we were talking about earlier.
Right. I really like that quote. But the other thing about is important to note about that quote is the EU Observer is not the only person saying this. I think they probably put it best, but there's a lot of people saying, we need to make big changes here. And so I think it leads very directly into two very important trends that we've been talking about at the Trumpet and then at the Plain Truth going back decades. And one is that the EU is going to become a much more robust union. It's going to move towards being a super state with one powerful figure at the head, something that much more closely resembles the United States, where you can't have a region of one country blocking everything. And so you're going to see a much greater centralization of powers. And you know, even before this, we saw lots of people calling for exactly that, and those calls have only grown louder. So that's one part of it. And then the other aspect is, you know, the Bible tells us that this is going to be a union of 10 nations. Right now there are 27. And with 27 nations, it's much easier. It's much harder to get this. I mean, it seems like it gets exponentially harder with each nation that you add. Mm-hmm. So to get an agreement from 27 nations is very difficult. And so when you, now people are thinking, well, okay, do we need to cut loose the rowing boats? Do we need to get rid of the nations that are holding us back, so that the much smaller group of nations that wants to make these trade deals, that wants to be more unified, can do that? And it's interesting because whenever you look at smaller groups of nations within the European Union that get together and say, well, we're really keen on a European army, or you had the Berlin group that got together a few years ago and that tried to hash out some ways for the Europe to get more integrated, it is always roughly 10 nations. Now, we're not saying that those are the final 10, but that's about the size that nations seem to get together at when they want to make progress. And so that's another vital trend that's going to come from just the mess that we see at the moment.
Very interesting, and congratulations for getting Canada into our broadcast today. You're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. The moment for some of you that you've been really anticipating, it's finally here. We're going to talk about the U.S. presidential election. It's just 10 days away. It seems every few days more outrageous information comes out about the candidates that makes voting for either of them an increasingly unsavory proposition. One of the latest regards the Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton. And for this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, well, this is definitely, I think, of all the things you could say of this election cycle, one of the biggest things that has people concerned is just how violent it's been compared to past election cycles. I think you'd probably have to go back almost like 1968 before you see another election cycle that's had this much rioting, this much protesting, and just this much violence. Mm-hmm. And I saw one poll this week just saying that I think it's well over half of Americans are very concerned in the aftermath of the election that there could be violence in the nation if their preferred candidate doesn't win. Could go either way. It's not just right. The Trump people saying that the Hillary people are going to riot if Trump wins, but the other way around as well. Mm-hmm. And then just this story we've got here in our Trumpet Weekly, just showing that's kind of like the big of all the leaks. They've had all the like email leaks and video leaks. They had another video leak this week of two key Democratic Party operatives in the Clinton campaign that they've got on tape instructing some of their staff to actually send agitators to Donald Trump campaigns in an attempt to stir up some of this violence. We've talked several times, even on this program, especially earlier in the year, about just some of the violence at the Trump rallies and how Mr. Trump was really making things worse on himself with even some of his rhetoric, to where you'll see like videos where he says like, well, I heard that there's someone with a tomato in the audience that might throw him, so if you see him, beat him up and I'll pay your legal fees. Mm-hmm. Or just many comments like that, where he's definitely not helped the situation, and the media's, especially mainstream media's, very much lambasted him for some of this rhetoric that may have stirred up some of this violence at his rallies. But now with this email leak, you can actually see that maybe perhaps anticipating this trend at his rallies, the Democratic Party's even been sending people in there from the outside on purpose to make it worse. In particular, and this is some of the more recent ones where Mr. Trump had refused to release his tax returns, you can see the one Democratic operative here telling people that to like dress up in a Donald Duck costume and go in there. And it's supposed to be like a word play off Donald's ducking his taxes and just be obnoxious to as many Trump supporters you can get in an attempt to actually encourage them to punch you. I've got one quote, which I'll have to alter ever so slightly just to get some of the bad language out of it. But it says this is from the video from Scott Fovell, who's a national field director for one of the PACs associated with Hillary Clinton, which he says, I mean, honestly, it's not hard to get some of these people to pop off. You can draw them out. You can draw them to punch you. So he basically says, like, get in a Donald Duck costume, just go to the rally, find someone who looks like they're kind of emotional, and just kind of like get in their face and be obnoxious. He said, if you can get them to punch you and get them on camera, that's a viable election strategy for us. And he even said in the video that Hillary Clinton, they ran the idea by her and she loved it. Now, obviously, Ms. Clinton's not in the video, so there's not necessarily proof of how high this goes up. I think the DNC is really trying to say that it's just these two guys, and one of them they fired and the other one resigned on his own. So they're both out of the campaign now, so it's kind of anybody's guess as to how more widespread this may have been, because there have definitely been these violent institutes going way back before the Donald Duck costume thing came up, where there's been people really speculating that, like, some of these people are definitely either Bernie Sanders supporters or Hillary Clinton supporters that seem like they were there to cause some trouble, and trying to figure out, like, well, were they there just of their own volition, or is this even more widespread with the one party sending agitators into the other to try to stir up this violence for electoral gain?
Yeah, it really seems emblematic of widespread problems this has really been a campaign strategy. If it's not coming from the candidates themselves, it's coming from some fairly high up people within each of the parties, particularly in the Democratic Party, aiming to use violence to their advantage. And you really have to think that they are playing with a much bigger fire than they realize.
That is definitely true. It's like a much bigger, you get some of these emotions stirred up, and like I said, maybe on some of the parts of these candidates and campaign strategists, this just might be, hey, it's not personal, this is just business, we're trying to win an election and we're using very Machiavellian means to do it. But amongst the supporters who are actually throwing punches at the rallies, this is very real and very this is very personal to them. And if the election goes in a way that they don't like, you could see that would be, even if that would be hard to rein some of that passion back in, even if, like, the people who stirred it up in the first place wanted to.
Well, it'll certainly be interesting to watch what happens here over the next couple of weeks and months as this election finally takes place and we see the aftermath. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about a message from ancient history to today's United Nations, the latest news from the Philippines firebrand President Duterte, how segregation is returning to American universities, and how Iceland is being taken over by pirates. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
There was an interesting juxtaposition of recent events regarding Israel, one that disputed the Jewish connection to Jerusalem, and the other that showed this connection going back almost three millennia. For this story, we're going to go back to Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, I'd like to start just reading Melanie Phillips' column in the Jerusalem Post today, because I think it sets it up quite well, what we saw this week in referring to these two issues that you're discussing. She writes, "This week, UNESCO doubled down on its shameful resolution erasing the historic connection of Judaism and Christianity to the Temple Mount, the Holy of Holies of the Jewish people, defining it instead exclusively as the Muslim holy site of worship." Now, UNESCO is in charge of ensuring the protection of historical sites. It's a world governing body for that. And yet they've come out with two resolutions over the past couple of weeks. And the latest one, again, didn't refer to the Christian roots of Jerusalem, or even the Jewish roots of Jerusalem, and just declared it as a Muslim holy site. And then before that, the resolution, like a week before that, said that, well, it condemned Israel for escalating aggressions and illegal measures against the department in charge of Israel's Muslim holy places, and deplored the continuous storming of Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Haram al-Sharif, by Israeli right-wing extremists and uniform officers. Basically, that's pretty much an outright lie, and yet UNESCO is backing this, purely pushing the Palestinian position that this holiest site in the old city of Jerusalem, for both the Jews and really for Christians as well, how that is purely a Muslim holy site, and that Jews are actually putting the sanctity of that Muslim holy site under threat. So UNESCO is basically rewriting the history of Jerusalem, completely sidelining the two major religions and two major people, well, religions being Christian and Judaism, but also the people that were there before, the Jews. And of course, Christ was a Jew. So you'd expect more people to be up in arms about that. So what happened the very same day that this second resolution was being brought to UNESCO's table and voted on and actually passed, we had two amazing, stunning discoveries. We'll just talk about one today, and that was a 7th century BCE papyrus, just basically ancient paper, and with some writing scribbled on it from 1400 years before Muhammad. And it actually is written in ancient Hebrew, and it has the word Jerusalem on it. So it's pretty decisively proving that the Jews were there far longer or far before the Muslims considered it a holy place.
And so these came out at the same time. The Jews are saying this is purely coincidental, but it is an interesting alignment of events here.
Yeah, it's a wonderfully beautiful alignment of events from the Jewish perspective. Whether or not it was coincidental or not, I mean, the fact remains that this is an irrefutable document written in ancient Hebrew script. You give it to I forget who studies ancient writings, but if you give it to one of those people, they'll say it's 7th century BC Hebrew. This is the reigns of evil King Manasseh, Amon, and righteous King Josiah. We don't really know exactly which under whose reign it was written, but it was found really well intact because it was stored in the Judean desert just above the Dead Sea, in a similar location to where the Dead Sea Scrolls were. And because of the dry temperature there, doesn't get much water, obviously, in the dry conditions, this bit of paper was preserved for 2,700 years. Now, what exactly did it say? There were two lines of text written on it, and if we're going to put it into English, it said, "From the king's maidservant, from Na'arat," which is a biblical city that's mentioned in the book of Joshua, on the outskirts of Jerusalem, "jars of wine to Jerusalem." So it actually mentions, written there perfectly. If you could read ancient Hebrew or even ancient, Canaanite or ancient Phoenician, you'd be able to read this as well. And it says that this is being sent from the king's maidservant, the king of Judea, the biblical king, to the capital city, Jerusalem. So it's indicative of a payment of taxes, transfer of goods, or something of that nature. And it is extremely strong proof that the Jews had something going on in Jerusalem back 1,400 years before Al-Aqsa Mosque was even thought of.
Well, thanks for that story, Brent. One of the most interesting leaders on the world scene today, usually not in a good way, is Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte. He's been fairly busy making headlines over the past couple of weeks. And for one of these headlines, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yep, like you said, hardly a week goes by that Duterte doesn't make a lot of news for his various insults to world leaders, his draconian domestic policies. But over the last 8 days or so, he's conducted a tour of Asia that shows the kind of tightrope that he's having to walk in his foreign policy posturing of the Philippines. And the details of this tour show that he has, I think, a pretty tough job ahead of him.
He doesn't seem like much of a tightrope walker.
Well, it may surprise you a little bit. The fact that he's gone to Japan, I think, really just demonstrates that he is trying to keep a lot of his options opened as best he can. But first, he spent several days in China, While he was there, he signed about $24 billion worth of deals with the Chinese. And when he first arrived there in China, he spoke really brazenly about wanting to totally end his relationship with the United States and instead tilt Manila totally toward the Chinese. But apparently, after he spoke behind closed doors with some of the Chinese leadership and actually heard the terms of the deals that China was offering to him, which were no doubt not very good for the Philippines, he backed off on those statements and basically said, you know what, our tilt toward the U.S. isn't so bad after all. We can't sever those ties completely, not right away anyway. So even though he did sign some major deals with the Chinese leadership, it's clear that some big issues didn't turn out the way he had hoped. And then just days after that trip, Duterte headed off to Japan, which is China's longtime rival and the Philippines' largest foreign investor and the Philippines' largest export market. And over the course of his three-day visit there in Japan, he struck dozens of major deals worth almost as much as the ones he made in China. It looks like they totaled about $20 billion. And Duterte also made plans with the Japanese to bolster the Philippines' maritime cooperation with Japan and to buy some Japanese aircraft and patrol vessels, which are going to really boost the Philippines' Coast Guard abilities. So it's clear that Duterte is trying to build his partnerships with both China and Japan. And that is, it's quite a tough balancing act, I think, since, you know, Beijing and Tokyo are such intense rivals. It's difficult to do that in a way that doesn't end up pushing one of them away, sort of alienating one for the sake of the other. And then, of course, America is also in the mix. Duterte has lashed out at the U.S. on multiple occasions. He's called for the American military to totally clear out of the country. But the people in the Philippines and the military establishment are not behind him in those kinds of things. A Wall Street Journal poll was published just this morning showing that the Philippines is the world's most pro-American country, with 92% of the people having a favorable view of America. That's more than even Americans. Only 82% of Americans on the poll had a favorable view of America. So he's got the people against him in that anti-U.S. push. Even more significantly are the powerful stakeholders across the Philippine political spectrum, especially those in the military. On the whole, they're really wary of Duterte's efforts to tilt away from America. And so that will really limit his room to maneuver. So basically what it looks like is that Duterte is just in this kind of precarious balancing act, at least in the short term. So far, his diplomatic agenda and his really unorthodox approach to politics have allowed him to reap significant economic concessions from the two Asian rivals, China and Japan, while also letting him maintain the negotiating strength that his alliance with the United States provides. But this, it is kind of a tightrope that he's walking on. That's what Stratfor called it in the article that we've published in the Trumpet Weekly. And I think his success in this balancing act will not last forever.
Very interesting, because we are definitely looking for this unification of Asian nations and America's real disappearance from that theater. And certainly Duterte's actions, when I saw those headlines initially where he was talking about how he just wanted to sever all contact with the United States, that was as bold as anything that we've ever seen out of the Philippines.
For sure.
The fact that he's having to back away from that, it's kind of interesting. Maybe gives you a little bit of a sense of a delayed timetable, and yet there really is an inevitability to that eventually.
Yeah, I think that we can expect China to begin pushing harder at the Philippines, especially with soft power, possibly even sweetening the terms of some of those deals that made Duterte sort of backtrack on those initial comments. And so if China's successful in that, then it would represent a real diminishment in American influence and a great boost, of course, in Chinese influence.
Thanks for that story, Jeremiah. We've been tracking the rise of right-wing and fringe political parties in Europe for some years now. One of these parties finding surprising success is in Iceland. And for this story, we're going to go back to Canada. That might be a little bit closer to Iceland than we are here. And we're going to hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, Iceland is about to be taken over by pirates. That's according to polls, at least. They forecast that this new upstart pirate party is going to be the largest party after Iceland's elections that will be held tomorrow. The polls say that they won't win outright. Iceland is one of those countries that's usually governed by a coalition, but they could well be the main party in a coming coalition government.
And this isn't quite as crazy as it sounds.
Well, I guess it does sound pretty crazy, but it is still genuine. I think this is one of the most extreme examples of this trend. I mean, you mentioned we've been following this trend for 5 years or more, but when you look at the Pirate Party in Iceland and one or two other events recently, it's definitely getting more and more extreme. And we can't let the fact that we've been tracking this trend for so long kind of desensitize us to the levels that it's reaching, because this is, I mean, this is quite a geeky party that is really right on the fringe of what you would expect to. I'm just blown away. Even the Pirate Party movement's founder is kind of blown away that one of their groups is actually coming close to power. The movement was founded in 2006, and you know, you probably remember in the earlier days of the internet, there was a lot of web or people sharing music online, and then companies trying to get the government to crack down on this online piracy. And the pirates movement kind of grew out of opposition to that, and partly a belief that information should be free and should be shared, and also then an opposition to governments cracking down on the internet. And it's just bizarre that a movement with those kind of roots is now close to government, and they've got strong links often to things like WikiLeaks. Now it's kind of morphed into almost like a democracy 2.0 movement that wants to use the web to fundamentally change how nations are governed. So for one of their key policies across all different countries, because this is there are pirate parties in a lot of countries, is to have their platforms determined by online votes of their members. And so rather than that makes them hard to characterize, because rather than saying, well, they're a left wing or a right wing, it just depends on the votes that they get. But it's it's just very surprising that they could be about to win in Iceland. But then it's not just Iceland in recent news. So Lithuania, they held two rounds of elections on the 9th and 23rd of November. The largest party there is a group called the Peasants and Green Party. And the remarkable thing about this party is this election, they won 54 seats. Last election, 4 years ago, they won one seat. So just like the pirates in Iceland, we are seeing this explosion in these type of groups that went nowhere recently. And it's a trend. I mean, it's hit Greece. You know, now it's hit Lithuania and Iceland, Portugal, Spain, France, Finland, the Netherlands, Sweden, a huge range of countries for a huge range of different areas. But it's such a large trend now that it should just be really obvious that this is going to have major impacts on Europe.
It seems like this Icelandic party that you're talking about, that it has elements of more sort of libertarian or even anarchic ideology. But then you're also talking about sort of the internet as a tool to facilitate democratic choice. But this really seems like an anti-EU type of a party in a lot of ways. Like this is very much against the kind of top-down regulatory bureaucracy type of government that you see within Europe generally.
Yes, yeah, to a certain extent. But what I think is also interesting, and the Lithuanian party exemplifies this more, and the Iceland party also ties in, but it's very much an anti-politician movement. You know, Iceland, they had a few leaks from the Panama Papers that exposed a whole load of corruption in their politicians. And what the Lithuanian party, one of their key platforms, is saying they're going to appoint a technocratic government. And there's a growing belief among a lot of these parties that politicians are corrupt and they're wrong, and both Lithuania and the pirates, they agree with that. And so now the Lithuania, they're saying, well, or this party is saying, well, we'd be better off governed by kind of non-elected intellectuals, bureaucrats who are experts in their field. And we've seen this across Europe. We've seen the European Union takes a lot of this approach. We've seen it even in the United States. I think you've written an article or two drawing attention to American leaders saying, well, the country would be better if we were just run by a panel of experts. Mm-hmm. And you could see elements of the Pirate Party getting on board with that. They're seeing the same problem, corrupt politicians, and they're putting forward a different solution to this Peasants and Green Party in Lithuania. But you could see them getting on board with some of this just anti-established politician, anti-politician type of government. But you know, what we come back to when we talk about this is we talk about the similarities with World War II and about how you had this rejection of mainstream political parties led to a rejection just of democracy and people saying democracy is finished, it doesn't work. We need to try these alternatives, fascism, communism. And we're starting to see now the same thing, that the liberal democracy, the way we've seen it, does not work. Pirate Party, it's more anarchic and libertarian and online polls. Lithuanian Peasants and Greens saying, well, we need just a technocratic government of experts. But what they agree on is the current model of liberal democracy has failed. And you could see that leading to really radical changes within Europe, which is exactly what we've been forecasting this trend leading to.
Good stuff. Thank you for that, Richard. The hold that political correctness has over American universities has gotten tighter and tighter in recent years. It's really affected race relations more and more among student bodies. We've gotten to the point now where some educators feel the solution is to return to segregation. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
All right, well, yes, undoubtedly, probably most of our longtime listeners have heard a lot about the microaggressions that have been happening at our universities. And for those few who maybe aren't in the know, a microaggression is a term which apparently on the surface doesn't look like it should be offensive, but deep down, apparently, it really is. Like an example of some of these microaggressions that you'll hear about on a university is, like, America is the land of opportunity. You'd think that wouldn't be a controversial statement, but apparently a lot of students are taking that like, well, if America is the land of opportunity, you're saying that nothing should be wrong in my life, so you're attacking me if I think there is something wrong in my life. It's just like these little nitpicky things that are really becoming a huge deal.
That make no sense.
That make no sense. But that is one of the strange ironies of this is that the original civil rights movement in the 60s, it was mostly university protesters protesting against segregated campuses, and they wanted all the races to be able to go to classes together. Now they're like ideological grandchildren, or maybe some cases even physical grandchildren, protesting on the universities. They're actually almost advocating a return to segregation, but with a slight twist to it, where originally the protest against segregation were that minority racial groups should be able to go into white-dominated areas. This return to segregation is like establishing like no whites allowed areas. Getting back with to that microaggression, they're saying, like I said, well, sometimes white people say things that they're offensive that they don't know are offensive, so they just shouldn't be in the cafeteria or our section of the cafeteria. And so you are seeing this where like University of Southern California, they haven't built it yet, but they've offered to do minority only housing groups, like no whites allowed in this dormitory, or like a leadership retreat. I forget which university that was, but they're preparing a leadership retreat where they said that it's like minority leadership retreat. No one who's white, or at least no one who identifies as white, will be able to go sign up for this class. And then the big news this week is mostly probably here like the safe spaces. You're saying, well, this is like a safe space on a university where no one's allowed to say anything offensive. I'm still not sure of the details on how they enforce that no one who comes into the safe space can say anything offensive. But in particular for this one, they're saying, well, we need like minority only safe spaces where no white people can come in there. So it's just a place where we can get away from them and not worried about them saying anything insensitive. So this week at like University of Berkeley in California, I think it was on Wednesday, they had like a big protest that they wanted more of these safe spaces where they had like the students like literally form like a human chain, just like linked hand to hand in front of the class spaces. And, wouldn't let any of the white students to class. They said if it was, they have like video footage to where if it was a minority student or a black student or Asian student, they'd say, okay, let them through. And then two people would let go of their hands and make a space. But if it was a white student, they kept their hands there. So it said, no white students in class today. And I guess there was a back door. So several of them were able to like crawl through a ditch and work their way through some bushes and get in the back way to at least keep their attendance grade up. But this is University of Berkeley, and it's most these universities seem in California, but it is something that is becoming more and more prevalent, especially California, and then spreading eastward.
Really horrifying response to they're trying to solve racial problems, and there's just no possible way that that's going to solve anything. That's definitely going to create more racial strife and lead to probably quite a bit more violence as well. It's definitely something to continue to watch. We appreciate that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly. This is our weekly news report. The stories that we're talking about on the program today are in this week's edition, and you can receive it every week for free in your email inbox. We're going to finish up the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's time for our lightning round. We're going to take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Richard.
On October 26th, NATO head Jens Stoltenberg, he announced that NATO would be sending thousands of troops to the Baltics and to Romania in 2017. These deployments, they're the biggest military buildups on Russia's border since the Cold War. And there'll be four NATO battalions in the Baltic states. One will be led by Canada. We'll get Canada in again then. One by the US, one by the UK, and one by Germany. So it's really interesting to see that build up, but then also to see as Germany is one of the top military leaders within NATO taking the lead on that project.
All right, we'll go now to Brent.
The Islamic State group appears to be using tens of thousands of people as human shields in and around Mosul, where Iraqi forces are waging a large-scale offensive aimed at retaking this city. The UN Human Rights Office said that ISIL's depraved, cowardly strategy is to attempt to use the presence of civilian hostages to render certain points, areas, or military forces immune from military operations, effectively using tens of thousands of women, men, and children as human shields. Apparently, about 200 people have been killed already by ISIS for refusing to submit to such orders.
We'll go now to Andrew.
Government representatives from the United States, Japan, and South Korea met in Tokyo yesterday and agreed to increase sanctions on North Korea in an attempt to get it to give up its nuclear ambitions. U.S. National Intelligence Director James Clapper has publicly called that goal a lost cause, saying that sanctions have not proved effective in the past under the North Korean regime, but it does show that those three nations are starting to take the threat from nuclear threat from North Korea at least a little bit more seriously.
All right, back to Richard.
German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble, he's called for a joint defense budget for the European Union at a speech in Berlin. You can go and read more about that in the Trumpet Weekly, but a lot of people are drawing attention to just how significant this is. In recent history, Germany, they've been pro-EU military union, but they've been anti-paying for it. And so the fact that kind of Mr. Austerity himself, the guy who's never wanting to open up Germany's purse strings for the rest of Europe, is now saying, well, we need a joint defense budget, could be a major development in a push for an EU army. And then on a similar note, his finance ministry is also committing to spend an extra $10 billion over the next few years until 2020 on Germany's army and improving its army at home.
All right, now over to Jeremiah.
Yesterday, China's Communist Party elevated President Xi Jinping to a new position. They said that Xi is now considered the, quote, core leader of China. So this is the first time the title has been bestowed on President Xi by the National Communist Party, and it's mostly a symbolic move, but it's just one more in a long list of indications showing that he has become China's most powerful leader in decades, and he's basically the Vladimir Putin of China.
All right, back over to Brent.
Is President Obama preparing a parting shot at Israel? That's what Charles Krauthammer asks in his column today. He says there have been indications for months that President Obama might go to the UN and unveil his own final status parameters for a two-state solution after the coming U.S. presidential election. And then that would be enshrined in a new Security Council resolution that could officially recognize a Palestinian state on the territory Israel came into possession during the Six-Day War. This means that unilaterally the United States is going to undermine land for peace, the basic tenet of the Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations for the past 40 years. Instead, they are going to get land for nothing.
All right, back over to Richard.
In the last couple of weeks while we've been off air, German Chancellor Angela Merkel took a trip to West Africa. And that trip really drew attention to Germany's deep military ties to the area. We've talked before about how they lead the EU training mission of Mali's police and army. These training missions are now expanding, so they're going to train the militaries of Chad, Niger, Burkina Faso, Mauritania. The German-led mission is expanding across the area. Germany's thinking of sending more troops there. They're also establishing a military base in Niger and thinking of getting much more involved in Nigeria. So a rapid expansion of German military activity in this area that we also see Iranian-backed militant groups expanding into as well. So you see that clash building in North and West Africa.
Back over to Andrew.
Well, for the first time in 25 years, the United States has abstained from a UN vote condemning its embargo on Cuba. This happened on Wednesday. The Nation of Israel was the only other abstentia in the vote, meaning that 193 nations condemned America's embargo on Cuba. Zero nations approved it, and the United States and Israel abstained. So this is just yet another sign that America is really getting behind the new initiative to lift that embargo in the near future.
All right, and we'll finish with Jeremiah.
We spoke before about Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte and just how his profanity-laced insults often make the headlines. But apparently just today, as he was flying from Japan back to the Philippines, he says that God spoke to him and told him not to cuss anymore. And Duterte says that he won't be cussing anymore based on this divine order. So sounds like we might finally be able to begin to sometimes quote the Philippine president.
All right. Well, I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. And we'd love to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that you hear on this program in our Week in Review are in The Trumpet Weekly and a whole lot more on top of that. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to the panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be here.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Plutarch. Spartans, do not ask how many are the enemy, but where are they? Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.